from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Recent developments between the U.S. and Cuba remained in the headlines Friday, capturing the lead in both the New York Times and the Washington Post, among many others. The Times, in particular, has looked favorably upon the president's decision to renew diplomatic relations with Cuba. It has also advocated for the reduction or elimination of sanctions against that country. President Obama explained that the reason driving the shift in policy was that the attempt to isolate Cuba and strangle it with sanctions just didn't work. Nevertheless, one day later, he signed sanctions laws against two of the countries that Washington loves to hate, Russia and Venezuela. RT's Guyan Chichikayan was in Washington and explained how the new bill fits into the regime of other recently adopted sanctions against Russia.
Expanding sanctions against Russia was a congressional initiative which the president signed but said he had no intention to impose new sanctions against Russia at the moment. So what this bill gives the president is the authority to impose further sanctions, but it remains up to him whether to do that or not. But the sanctions that the Obama administration had already imposed on Russia are quite extensive. Under those, some of Russia's largest banks and firms are not allowed to borrow money in the West for more than 30 days. They also banned certain exports to Russian defense and energy firms. In a statement this Thursday, President Obama said, "We remain prepared to roll back sanctions should Russia take the necessary steps," end of quote.
Another bill signed by President Obama Thursday authorized sanctions against Venezuela. Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro, in a tweet late Thursday, pointed out the contradictions in the U.S. actions. Referring to the U.S. president, he wrote, quote, "On the one hand, he recognizes the failure of the aggression against and blockade of Cuba, which with dignity has resisted and won. And on the other hand, he has started a stage of increased aggressions against Venezuela," closed quote.
Hey, 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 stop it! Get off of him! Stop.
Another case involving New York police is stoking outrage in the Big Apple, as an NYPD officer was caught on video repeatedly beating a 12-year-old boy. Press TV's Kaniz Fatima reports.
Another case of U.S. police violence against African Americans. An unidentified white officer has allegedly struck a black 12-year-old boy in New York City. Video footage shows a plainclothes officer punching the boy repeatedly as he was being handcuffed by four other officers. A second 12-year-old boy was also handcuffed. The children had supposedly pushed one of their classmates in school. New York Police Department's Internal Affairs Bureau is currently investigating the incident. Public awareness has grown about unwarranted police violence against blacks in the past months after the killing of three black men this summer at the hands of police. However, no officers have been indicted, arrested, or formally charged for the deaths.
With protesters in the streets across the country under a banner of Black Lives Matter, President Barack Obama was asked about the relative condition of African Americans in the country at the end of the third quarter of his presidency. At a year-end press conference held at the White House, White House correspondent April Ryan asked the president to compare conditions for Black America now with the conditions that existed in January 2009.
I've been consistent in saying that this is a legacy of a troubled racial past of Jim Crow and slavery. That's not an excuse for black folks. And I think the overwhelming majority of black people understand it's not an excuse. They're working hard. They're out there hustling and trying to get an education, trying to send their kids to college. But, they're starting behind oftentimes in the race. And what's true for all Americans is we should be willing to provide people a hand up, not a handout, but help folks get that good early childhood education, help them graduate from high school, help them afford college. If they do, they're going to be able to succeed, and that's going to be good for all of us. Now, obviously, how we're thinking about race relations right now has been colored by Ferguson, the Garner case in New York, a growing awareness in the broader population of what I think many communities of color have understood for some time, and that is that there are specific instances, at least, where law enforcement doesn't feel as if it's being applied in a colorblind fashion. The task force that I formed is supposed to report back to me in 90 days, not with a bunch of abstract musings about race relations, but some really concrete, practical things that police departments and law enforcement agencies can begin implementing right now to rebuild trust between communities of color and the police department. And my intention is to, as soon as I get those recommendations, to start implementing. Some of them we'll be able to do through executive action. Some of them will require congressional action. Some of them will require action on the part of states and local jurisdictions. But I actually think it's been a healthy conversation that we've had. These are not new phenomena. The fact that they're now surfacing, in part because people are able to film what have just been in the past stories passed on around a kitchen table, allows people to make their own assessments and evaluations. And you're not going to solve the problem if it's not being talked about.
And now we move to our weekly segment with Tony Solo, our reporter from south of the border, looking at the scene in Central and South America and the Caribbean. We got a lot to cover. Of course, we had the big announcement on Wednesday that the U.S. was going to restore diplomatic relations with Cuba after 54 years. It'll be in January of this coming year. And a lot of fallout from that. We had the ALBA conference. We had a whole bunch of other stuff going on. So pick it up wherever you like, and let's get into this.
Wait. Yeah, thanks, Don. It's incredibly complicated, isn't it? Because there's so much going on. And the meaning of the liberation of the three remaining Cuban anti-terrorists is having quite significant reverberations around the region. And worth bearing in mind that the reason that the case of the so-called Cuban Five was so iconic and emblematic for people in Latin America is that it was such a profound contradiction between and a very important contradiction between the avowals of the United States that it was fighting terrorism and the reality.
Right.
Because the five Cuban anti-terrorists who were subject to what turned out to be 16 years incarceration for most of them, were in fact in the United States to try and investigate a terrorist activity against the people of Cuba originating from United States territory.
Right.
And that's what they were imprisoned for.
Right. Yeah, they were fighting terrorism, and the terrorists were being harbored here by the government, and which worked in collaboration with them.
Yeah, and of course the person, the super terrorist that has been harbored by the United States is this guy Luis Posada Carriles,
right. Who's an escapee from jail.
For blowing up a Cuban airline, I think it was in 1976.
And was arrested, convicted, and escaped from jail, and he's being harbored in the United States right now. And the media here, all they can do is talk about Assata Shakur.
Yeah, so, you know, and that contradiction between United States government policy and what they're actually do in practice, what the authorities actually do in practice, it may not be fair to impute that contradiction directly to President Obama. But in many ways, people throughout Latin America and governments throughout Latin America see the recent decision, that this week's decision by President Obama to exchange the three Cuban anti-terrorists for somebody, Alan Gross, who is actually a promoter of terrorism,
right,
in Cuba, as extremely symbolic.
Yeah.
And they see it as an implicit recognition by President Obama and his government of the deep contradiction between U.S. avowals of promoting peace and fighting terrorism in the world and what they actually do in practice.
Mm. You know, also, that, what's interesting here is, to a large degree, the celebrating over the release of the last three of the Cuban Five is due to the fact that people who were engaged in a global, international, effort to free them feel that they won. It was a victory that was forced by this organizing internationally in support of the Cuban Five.
Yeah, and it takes us back, as you said in an earlier text message before we came on air, and it's part of the, how long can the United States carry on pretending that everybody else in the world is isolated except them?
Yeah, right. That's the old, the whole world is crazy except for me, that usually lands
in
the hospital.
That is right.
And it's like the last pronouncement before the Thorazine hits.
Yeah, and this year again, you had that, the ritual vote in the United Nations, in which out of what is it, 192 or 193 countries in the world, only the United States and Israel and a couple of tiny Pacific atolls voted in favor of the blockade or against the resolution and calling for the end of the blockade against Cuba.
Actually, it was only the United States and Israel, and then the little islands that are basically U.S. military bases, two of them or three of them this year, abstained. Otherwise, the entire world voted for the resolution.
That gives you the international context, doesn't
really,
it?
Yes,
and,
it does.
But I'm getting down to the regional nitty-gritty of what the meaning, the decision by President Obama means. I mean, what you've got is, you've got even Juan Manuel Santos, a very, very close ally of the United States, welcoming the decision as one that ultimately promotes peace and democracy in the region.
While his government conducts peace talks with FARC in Havana.
Yeah, and that's, and he said in his declarations, in relation to the decision by President Obama, that for people in Colombia, the decision was another step forward towards a Latin America completely committed to peace.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And in the context of the negotiations currently happening in Havana between the Colombian government and the Colombian guerrilla, and that strikes me as extremely important.
Sure, absolutely.
Because it seems there is a lot of people here in Latin America take the decision as a victory for the Cuban people. And I think it is, in a deep sense, a victory for the resilience of the Cuban people against the U.S. blockade, against this grotesquely unjust decision to, the injustice system of the United States, and which people, African American people in the United States, are all too familiar with. But I mean, in this case, it was applied to the five Cuban anti-terrorists, and it seems to me that this is a victory of the Cuban people over that injustice system. So, and the wider regional meaning of that is that it's a victory for the whole progressive trend in Latin America against United States and European dominance in the region.
Absolutely. You know, within that context, let me interrupt for a second. The the victory is, of course, over a tactic. The United States is changing tactics and not a strategic goal of changing the government and the economic system in Cuba, and of putting to rest the entire project of integration in that region. That, I mean, it's clear that that's still their goal, but they have been forced by the Cuban people and by the international support for Cuba to acknowledge the failure of their attempt to strangle the country into submission. And after 54 years, they were forced to abandon that tactic and admit that it doesn't work. But the caveat here is, and yesterday Bernard White interviewed Dr. Gerald Horn. He said, remember that Libya reached a rapprochement with the U.S. like 3 years before it was leveled by the U.S. and NATO and Gaddafi was murdered. So you got to keep your eyes open going forward, too.
Yeah, and of course one has to have add the observation that Cuba is a very different society to Libyan society, because
sure.
What was and the huge achievement of Muammar Gaddafi was to maintain some kind of national cohesion in a country that was consistently trying to tear itself apart because of the different rivalries of its tribal society. And Cuba is a very different society, obviously.
Well, the U.S. will try to work that. You know, the U.S. will work on accelerating class divisions to the extent they can with the money, you know, the money transfers and such, and also racial, as if they could lecture Cuba on race relations, but also racial divisions and any other divisions they can find within the society. They will try to exacerbate it, but it is an entirely different animal, and the people who for 54 years have been forced into cohesion by being under siege from the United States all that time.
Yeah. And there's so many, aren't there? And there are just so many different aspects to this decision that and we're never going to cover it. Even if we were talking for hours and hours and hours, we'd just never cover all the different aspects.
This is true.
But one of the aspects is the media attempt, the corporate media attempt to idiotize their audience. And so, for example, you get people talking about the pink tide in Latin America, or you'll get them talking about orange revolutions.
Right.
And what those media soundbite terms mean are really quite complex processes.
Mm-hmm.
Because when people talk about the pink tide in Latin America, what they're talking about are the deep roots of indigenous and popular resistance to elite dominance backed by foreign powers.
Right.
And then when they talk about orange revolutions, which is the kind of thing that they're trying to do in Venezuela at the moment, which they'll probably ultimately try and do in Cuba sometime in the future, as you so correctly said. The orange revolutions is a kind of toolbox, an imperialist toolbox of techniques to destabilize a country before trying to provoke political change, regime change, that will make the country do what the United States and its NATO allies want.
Right. That's right. I mean, you saw efforts those lines with the Twitter thing and the hip-hop thing that they tried to do. And can we say this as a musician, a jazz musician, that there's no way in hell that the U.S. is going to use Disney hip-hop to make any inroads into the music scene in Cuba?
All right, by the way, Don, do you remember that last year Ezra Brown, the very extremely talented New York musician, came to Nicaragua and gave a concert last year?
Yeah, I remember you.
Well, he did this year as well.
Oh, cool.
And it was a very, very successful, outstanding, it was one of the outstanding cultural events here in Nicaragua during the year. So many thanks to Ezra Brown.
Yeah, nice. Did you get to go?
No, I never get to go. I'm always stuck
working,
here doing the community project stuff in Esteli. I never get down to Managua.
The life of a revolutionary.
So anyway, I'm getting back to the wider regional significance. There's all kinds of things were happening over the last 10 days.
Right.
In our last conversation, Don, we forgot to mention that last weekend was going to be at one of the ALBA summits,
right,
the Bolivarian Alliance of the Americas. And at that summit, very important decisions were taken, including the incorporation of St. Kitts and Nevis, the island nation, the Caribbean island nation, and also the Caribbean island nation of Grenada.
Mm.
They are both now full ALBA members.
Wow, great.
So with full rights, the equal rights to all the other member nations of the ALBA group.
Which means equal. That means they have one vote, like everybody else does when they vote on major
like
matters of policy.
Else, you know, very, very, very different to other international fora like the IMF or the World Bank, for example, where the United States still has its ridiculous weighted domination against, for example, the United States still has more votes than China, far more votes than China, and even a country like France or the United Kingdom have more votes than China in the IMF. Isn't that absurd?
Right.
So that was very important. And then, of course, there was also, and they confirmed their commitment to developing an integrated economic and development cooperation bloc within Central America and the Caribbean and Venezuela. So, and that was tremendously important. And they confirmed their commitment to developing the Petro-Caribe group, which includes many countries that are far from progressive, you know, in terms of their politics, like, for example, Guatemala or, like, for example, Jamaica.
Right.
But those countries are very much integrated into the Petro-Caribe initiative, which is very much a child of ALBA.
Right. What happened with Bolivia? What happened with Bolivia? Because I know they had an application pending.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm Bolivia, and now I'm in the first few months of 2015. They will now be a full member of Mercosur.
All right.
And that is tremendously important, Don, because for years and years and years, Mercosur was virtually moribund in terms of its relations with the rest of the world and in terms of its relationship even with the rest of Latin America. Mercosur was practically moribund. The four founder members of Mercosur are Argentina, Brazil, Uruguay, and Paraguay, right?
Right.
So now, over the last couple of years, Venezuela's now been integrated into Mercosur, which is part of the great vision of Comandante Eterno Hugo Chavez Frias.
Right.
And now Bolivia is going to be integrated into Mercosur. And so you have two of the most important countries in ALBA. In Bolivia, Bolivia's economy is still relatively weak compared to the other countries in Latin America. But Bolivia's dynamism is a kind of moral dynamism.
Yeah.
And they, you know, and their redistributive policies, their policies in favor of indigenous people, and that is going to completely transform the thinking, the dynamics of Mercosur.
Oh, sure. Also, the weight of the votes too. So, I mean, you now have you have Uruguay, which is essentially a leftist government. You have Bolivia, and you have Venezuela. I mean, the center of political gravity is definitely shifted to the left within the organization.
And Argentina, too, John.
Yeah, with a leftist president, right?
And I think this tremendous importance of Mercosur's acceptance of Bolivia is going to be the strength that it gives Dilma Rousseff.
Right, that's true.
And Cristina Kirchner.
That's right.
Because what you have with Dilma and Cristina, you have two tremendously progressive leaders who are constantly embattled against their entrenched right-wing business opposition.
Right.
And so what you get with the incorporation of Mercosur is a tremendous reinforcement of the ideological positions of Cristina and whoever her successor may be. One just has to hope in 2015 that Cristina can't stand for the presidency in 2015, but we hope that some ally of hers will actually win the election, presidential election in 2015. Things will get very complicated if the right wing win the presidential election in Argentina next year.
Right.
But let's see what happens. But the importance is that incorporation of Bolivia, even if a right wing president is elected in Argentina, God forbid.
Yeah.
And that will give Mercosur's the political balance in favor of redistributive, genuinely grassroots democratic policies in Latin America is tremendous.
Yep, absolutely true. I know it. I mean, if you just looking at almost every major development in that region, even when we're, you know, sitting here watching it teeter from time to time, like with the Brazilian elections for a while, ends up being resolved in favor of the forces for integration, for a more egalitarian society, and for sovereignty and regional solidarity. So the developments are startling to watch and very reassuring to somebody in his early 60s wondering what the planet's going to be like after he's gone.
Well, yeah, absolutely. And of course, getting back to the five, one of the interesting aspects of the decision by President Obama is that he consulted with the countries of what's called in Latin America the Pacific Alliance. That's Mexico, Colombia, Peru, and Chile.
Right.
And of course, in Chile, you have a relatively progressive government under Michelle Bachelet. And in Peru, you have a strongly nationalist government under Ollanta Humala. In Colombia, you've got this weird situation going on with a long-standing right-winger like Juan Manuel Santos, who's been kind of, one way or another, events are leading him into an integrationist stance in terms of Latin America, Latin America's regional politics. And in Mexico, you've got Peña Nieto, who is Mexico's traditional leadership of... Yeah, and Mexico for decades was the country that recognized Cuba. And it was only with the arrival of this guy, I've even forgotten his name, the PAN president who won by Fox, right. Vicente Fox. And it was only with the arrival of Vicente Fox that relationships between Mexico and Cuba and the progressive governments began. For example, during the 1980s, Mexico was a key player in sustaining the Nicaraguan Revolution because of its energy policies in favor of the Nicaraguan Revolution.
Right.
And then when Vicente Fox came to power in the early 2000s, and he kind of reversed Mexican foreign policy. And now you can see that under Enrique Peña Nieto, that move by Enrique Fox that was modified slightly under Felipe Calderón, his successor, and that is now being reversed, and it's actively being reversed under Peña Nieto, for example. For example, Mexico has tremendously good relations with Nicaragua at the moment.
Mm. And he has his own pressure in the streets, of course, too. We're going to have to stop here, but the Mexican president right now is looking at a good part of the population in rebellion against the institutions of the country.
Yeah, because of the Ayotzinapa massacre.
That's right.
And all these things are connected. And one way or another, there's nothing that's going to stop for the next 10 years or so, at least, the development of Latin America's newfound autonomy, sovereignty, and independence in vis-a-vis the United States and certainly vis-a-vis Europe.
Yeah, absolutely true. All right, Tony, we got to leave it there. Thanks a lot. As usual, a pleasure. We'll speak with you again next week.
Okay, thanks a million, Don. Take care. Have a good weekend.
Thank you. You too.
Yeah. Welcome home to the Cuban Five. Welcome home, Gerardo. Welcome home, Ramon. Welcome home, Antonio. Long live the Cuban Revolution. Long live the Cuban Revolution. Yeah. Welcome home to the last of the Cuban Five. 16 years after they were thrown inside U.S. dungeons for fighting against terror, inflicted for 5 decades against the fairer, more just, more equal society. The Cuban Revolution overcame realities of subjugation, a small island country that shook off its status as a colony from the domination of the Spanish, replaced by the capitalists of the U.S. Once a hub for the Miami Mafia, Americans owned most of the land and had command over what was called the brothel of the Caribbean. But after 1959, then we started seeing a shift away from the master towards asserting control over resources, poverty averting. Fidel said, we are nobody's backyard. We can run our own affairs, this whole island's ours. What is more democratic than dignity? The right to a job, to a home, a sense of living, to finally read and write, to no longer slave, to proclaim socialism is a brand new day. The revolution inside the revolution, to give women equal rights, no more prostitution. The long history of Cuban internationalism, like the fight against apartheid, to recognize the rights of oppressed people to freedom. Ironic that the U.S. would have...
And that's all the news we have for you right now.
For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.